usually when I introduce a speaker, I peek at what the speaker has put up on the on his first transparency, and I purposely did that. What the problem here is that all the my son was writing an essay in French, actually, and he ran spell check on it just to see what happened. So what happened here is that all the letters got out of order, and I will show you what happens if you put them back in order. So that's what it looks like. So what I'm going to talk to you about is some of the sort of more physical applications of what I talked about in the seminar that I gave yesterday. I know that some of you went and some of you didn't go. So I will make a very, very, very short sort of summary at some point. But I guess you have to begin with a table of contents. So this is a table with contents. But the problem is that I flew here from Los Alamos, where I'm spending the year, and the pilot warned us that some of the contents may have settled during shipping because it was a very bumpy flight. So what I was talking about in the seminar was non-Hermitian Hamiltonians. Just to sort of put it in context, this is a striated hermit crab, and that is a tiny right-handed hermit crab. But this is a non-Hermitian crab. You'll have to live with some of these jokes. Anyway, I hope what I'm telling you is that
those of us who are sitting here in the front can't just sneak out the door.
Yes. So basically, I talked to you about PT symmetry. This is. Is this big enough to read? I hope it is. This is the original class of non-Hermitian PT symmetric Hamiltonians that I worked on. Epsilon is a real parameter, a real positive parameter. And this class of Hamiltonians is non-Hermitian, but as I told you in this original paper that I wrote with my student, Stefan Becher, the spectrum of these Hamiltonians is all real and positive. There are lots of interesting special cases. P squared plus ix cubed is an example of a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian whose spectrum is entirely real and positive and discrete. And this Hamiltonian here, p squared minus x to the 4, an upside down potential, is another interesting example. It's what you obtain by setting epsilon equal to 2. And this is another Hamiltonian whose spectrum is real and positive and discrete. And that's a very radical thing to say. It is unusual. Let me say that the secret is in the boundary conditions, but this result is quite surprising and unusual and I think amazing. What happened after I introduced these classes of non-Hermitian PT symmetric Hamiltonians is that a whole industry has come up. First of all, the result that I have given you, namely that the spectrum of this is real, positive, and discrete for all epsilon that are positive, greater than or equal to 0. There's a whole industry that has come up. There are hundreds and hundreds of papers now published on PT symmetry. There have now been 6 international conferences talking about these different types of Hamiltonians. So it's been a real trip. So this has really been a fantastic experience. I have to say I'm having more fun doing physics now than I've ever had in my whole life. This is so interesting. I will show you what the spectrum looks like for these Hamiltonians. So this is Here are the Hamiltonians, p squared plus x squared times ix to the epsilon. And as epsilon increases from 0, this is a graph that I showed in the last talk, you can see that each of the energy eigenvalues flows continuously with epsilon. The spectrum remains real and positive, and it doesn't do what you naively think. It simply doesn't. And so if you start with the harmonic oscillator, which is Hermitian and PT symmetric, and you maintain the PT symmetry but lose the Hermitian property as soon as epsilon increases, the energy eigenvalues just move continuously as functions of epsilon. At epsilon equals 0, the eigenvalues are the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator, namely 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and so on. Okay? And that's sort of a very quick summary of what I said. The theme of the talk that I gave yesterday, the theme of that talk was that there is one axiom of quantum mechanics which doesn't, to me, sound like physics. It sounds like mathematics. It sounds like a mathematician who walked into a physicist's office and said, here's a convenient axiom for you. And the physicist adopted it. And the axiom is the axiom of Dirac hermeticity. Okay, and that, I'm arguing, is a very, very mathematical axiom. The axiom that the Hamiltonian must be Hermitian. It is a mathematical axiom because what you are saying is that if you take the Hamiltonian and you replace, you take the complex conjugate and then you take the transpose, you're supposed to get back the same Hamiltonian. All the other axioms of quantum mechanics are terribly physical sound, very physical sounding, okay? If you require that your Hamiltonian that is supposed to describe the world have Lorentz invariants, that's a very physical condition. It sounds like physics, okay? Lorentz invariants is physics, not mathematics. Okay? But this axiom, namely that if you take the transpose and complex conjugate, that is, you take the Dirac Hermitian conjugate of the Hamiltonian, the requirement that you get back the same Hamiltonian does not sound like physics. And I'm going to replace that axiom with the condition that H is equal to HPT. That is, if you reflect space and time simultaneously, that is a very nice, simple physical requirement. And I point out that it is undeniably physical because P and T are elements of the Lorentz group. It couldn't be more physical. And if you do that, what you wind up with is Hamiltonians that indeed have, if the PT symmetry is not broken, and I talked about what is meant by a broken symmetry, if it's not broken, you wind up with a real positive spectrum, okay? And which is certainly the most basic requirement of a Hamiltonian. So what I'm saying is very radical. I mean, this is not the conventional seminar. This is a very radical statement. Yeah.
So is the whole reason that hermeticity was invoked was to make sure that the eigenvalues were real?
No, it wasn't. That was half of it, okay? And I'm going to get to the second half. The other half is, of course, that you want this to be quantum mechanics. You want to preserve probability, and you want to have a unitary time evolution, and I haven't said anything about that yet. But what I talked about in my talk yesterday was that, in fact, not only do you preserve the spectrum, being the reality of the spectrum, but in fact, even though these Hamiltonians are not Hermitian, you preserve the condition of unitarity. And I'll summarize that briefly. If you weren't at the talk yesterday, I'll give you a reference to it. Okay. In any case, let me give you an overview of what I said. This is an overview of my talk. Okay, so I hope this is perfectly clear. This is definitely an overview of my talk last time. So maybe you, had you gone, you would have had a very restful seminar. I don't remember a thing I said anyway, so it doesn't make a difference. Okay, so The question you just asked, I'm going to parrot it back to you, was, okay, so the spectrum is real and positive, that's nice, but what about unitarity? Okay, in other words, did I just mention to you, am I talking about quantum mechanics, or is this just acute Sturm-Liouville problem? And it took us a while to get the answer to that question. It's a very, very hard question. Okay, and this was answered in two Physical Review letters, one in 2002 for quantum mechanics and one in 2004 for quantum field theory. And we showed that not only is the spectrum real and positive, but in fact, the theory maintains unitarity. And it took me a while to explain it, but I will just sort of summarize it in a very, very brief transparency. The answer is that the answer to that question is yes, you have unitarity. And the way you demonstrate unitarity is you construct a C operator in precisely the same way that Dirac did when he was facing the Dirac equation. He had just discovered the Dirac equation. He took the square root of the D'Alembertian. He wrote the Dirac equation not as a second order wave equation, but as a first order wave equation using matrices, okay, using Dirac matrices. And he found that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian was not bounded below. There were positive energy states and negative energy states. And the negative energy states were unbounded below. And he also found that probability was not real. I mean, was not positive. Okay, so it appeared that the wave equation, the quantum mechanical problem that he had constructed, was not valid. And then he made a brilliant observation. He argued that, in fact, the inner product in the process of doing this had changed. It was not the inner product, the simple inner product of A dagger B, whatever. That's not the correct inner product. But in the inner product, you need another matrix, which he called C. And this refers to charge conjugation. And he was able to then convert the problem using this matrix into a problem that was physically accepted. He changed the definition of the inner product. Okay, and that's exactly what you have to do for this problem. Instead of using Dirac inner product, you have to change it. And this is merely a summary. What you do is you invent a new operator, which is a linear operator, just a matrix, which I'm going to call C in honor of Dirac. Okay, and the properties of C are, first of all, that it is linear. Secondly, C squared is 1. So it acts like a charge conjugation operator. It's a reflection matrix. C squared is unity. C commutes with PT. That is, it has space-time reversal symmetry, or space-time reflection symmetry. And finally, C commutes with the Hamiltonian. By the way, this C operator, in the limit as epsilon goes to 0, where you recover the harmonic oscillator, the Hermitian Hamiltonian, in that limit, C approaches just parity. So for real Hamiltonians, for real Hermitian Hamiltonians, there is no C operator. You can't construct such an operator. But for complex Hamiltonians, like the ones I showed you, C is a distinct operator. C, by the way, in quantum field theory is a Lorentz scalar. And what is the inner product that is preserved? Why do we have unitarity? If you use the correct inner product, which is the CPT inner product, you end up, the CPT inner product has the virtue, first of all, that it is strictly positive. You have a positive norm. And because C commutes with the Hamiltonian and PT commutes with the Hamiltonian, this inner product is preserved. And so you do not lose probability. You have a unitary theory. And that's the resolution of the problem, both in quantum mechanics and in quantum field theory. And so, in other words, I'm saying the inner product, what this symbol means, the correct definition, you would usually write the adjoint over here, but now what you have to write is CPT. And this is a strictly positive norm. That is, if you take the dot product of any vector in the Hilbert space with itself, the answer is positive, strictly positive, and it only vanishes if that vector is zero. Okay, that's the resolution of the...
Just to make sure.
Yep.
that this C is not the usual charge conjugation.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. In fact, it's strictly speaking, I know, maybe it's nasty of me to use the same letter, but there's only a finite number of letters, and I thought that was cool.
And in the field theory context, is it still H equals HPT and not CPT, where C is the...
Oh, H
the
is...
C of...
I'm saying, we're assuming that H commutes with PT. We're assuming that H has PT symmetry, that is, it commutes with PT. And what I'm saying is that if you write down these three simultaneous equations for your Hamilton, for your field theoretic, say you write down a phi cubed, so you've been taught when you were a child in kindergarten, you studied quantum field theory, and you, for example, if we're talking about a field theoretic Hamiltonian, you studied, for example, this quantum field theory. Okay. And then you put on some cubic interaction, and that's where you first learned about Feynman diagrams. And your teacher, whoever it was, told you, of course, we know this doesn't have a ground state. It isn't bounded below, but we can practice perturbation theory, and you learned about perturbation theory in this theory. Okay? And if your teacher had only said to you this theory, now this would have been a perfectly acceptable quantum field theory. Okay? Because this theory does have a ground state. And everything about this quantum field theory is just wonderful. And this is the thing that corresponds with an IX cubed quantum capital theory.
Right, and but what I was asking is going back to one of the previous slides, that it's H equals HPT.
Indeed.
Not
so
H equals...
That's right.
HCPT, where C is charge conjugate.
Exactly. So this theory here is symmetric under space-time reflection. And to see that, we'll take phi to be a pseudoscalar, so that under parity, phi changes sign. So that's invariant under parity. This is invariant under parity. That changes sign under parity. Okay. But under time reversal, I changes sign. And so this quantum field theory is symmetric under PT. So H commutes with the combined space-time reflection. Okay. Once we know that, we can then solve simultaneously these three equations. And I have a physical review letter on that and how to do that. And you can construct the C operator. And if you do so, you'll find the C operator is a scalar. Okay. You can't construct it for this theory exactly, but I will show you in a moment a theory for which you can find the perform the construction. And then, in that case, everything works. And this theory is a perfectly acceptable theory with a ground state. It's unitary. It's a wonderful, new, and interesting quantum mechanical theory. Okay.
How unique is C?
That's a very interesting question. This, I believe, has a unique solution. Now,
well, C equals 1 is a solution. Those three equations.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Now, subject, hang on. So subject to certain conditions which are technical, okay, and I want to, and you have to, there is implicit here the condition that as you turn off the coupling constant, if you calculate this perturbatively, okay, as you turn off the coupling constant and recover just this theory, okay, C has to reduce to the parity operator.
Okay.
And that is another condition. It's a condition, a perturbative condition, if you're doing a calculation of C, and that is the condition, I believe, that makes it unique. Okay. Any non-uniqueness has to do with the unitary redefinition of the states in the quantum Hilbert space. Okay. But other than that, I believe that C is a unique operator. There are not two different Cs up to those conditions. Okay. So that's a technical theory. Okay. So the bottom line, and this is the end of the summary, the bottom line is that H is self-adjoint with respect to CPT. It is a self-adjoint Hamiltonian, okay, and it's self-adjoint not with respect to Dirac hermeticity, but with respect to CPT. This is a unitary operator, okay, And the novelty is that the inner product in the Hilbert space is dynamically determined by the Hamiltonian itself. You change the Hamiltonian, you get a different C operator. So the Hilbert space is determined by the Hamiltonian. You don't pick the Hilbert space until after you have solved the quantum mechanics problem. Okay? Now, what I was going to do was spend about 5 minutes just very quickly, because there's one specific application that I want to show you today that is something that we discovered just a few weeks ago and I've just put on the web a few weeks ago. And I'm really excited about this. But I will summarize just very briefly some of the applications and properties of PT symmetric Hamiltonians. I should say at this point that, I'm really turned on by this. So I'm so turned on that I decided to wear my T-shirt. I don't know if anybody reads Portuguese here, you'll know what this says. If not, I will translate it roughly for you. I don't speak Portuguese, but it says basically, if PT is in your heart, I want to speak to you. Well, I assume the fact that you're here means that PT is in your heart, and here I am speaking to you. So it's really good. So here are some physical applications using PT. You can make cars, and you can also make boats. Actually, that's PT-109, Jack Kennedy's book. And I have to just one last boast. I have to tell you that right where I live in St. Louis, I don't know if you could see, it doesn't quite come out, but this is a chain of sex clubs, and I was delighted to see that right here in St. Louis, there is a PT sex club, and I have to go across the river and get my picture taken there. Standing under the sign. But if you are only interested in physics, I will be serious. There are lots of places where PT shows up. Back in the 1950s, my thesis advisor, whom I admire more than anybody, basically, wrote one of his massive papers, one of his tour de force papers, in which he was able to quantize a system of interacting hard spheres. This is an incredibly giant calculation, and he was able to calculate the ground state energy exactly, and he was able to show that it was real and positive and so on. But people criticized his work very severely, and that is because, you know, he had to go to spherical coordinates, and in spherical coordinates, the momentum, there's a problem with the momentum operator in spherical coordinates, as you may know. And so his Hamiltonian in spherical coordinates was in fact not Hermitian. And yet he claimed that the energy was real. And when people criticized him, he simply couldn't answer the question. He said, I did the calculation, the energy is real. And people said, but this is garbage because your Hamiltonian is not Hermitian. A few years ago, I went back and looked at the calculation. It's almost obvious what is going on. In fact, his Hamiltonian was PT symmetric. And that's all. No problem at all. In the 1970s, there was a whole industry of people, and this is just a partial list of names, and I apologize if you've worked on it and your name isn't here, because there are thousands of such people. But Abarbanel and Bronson and Sugar and White and Brouwer and Furman and Moshe and Tan and Tan and so on worked on these problems. And this goes under the name of Region field theory, where you're trying to describe high energy scattering and the Pomeron. And basically what it comes down to is solving an I-phi cubed quantum field theory. These people knew that this field theory was not Hermitian. And in fact, they did some numerical calculations and found real energy levels for particles, but they didn't have an explanation for what was going on, so it was just some sort of... regarded as some sort of formal advance. But in fact, it's very straightforward. This field theory, which is the field theory that I wrote on the board over here, in fact, is a PT symmetric theory, and there isn't any problem with having real energy levels and unitarity and so on. Perfectly acceptable theory, and in fact, it justifies the formal work that these people were doing. In the 1970s and 1980s, there was another burst of activity on what was called the Liang edge singularity, and lots of people, Fisher and Cardi and Musardu and Zamolodchikov and so on, worked on these papers. And again, the underlying quantum field theory is an IFIQ quantum field theory. If you read their papers, they say, of course, the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, and so in some sense what we're saying is not right. But in fact, that's not true. It was right. It was fully justified, and this is a perfectly acceptable quantum field theory. In the 1980s, there were a whole series of papers, mostly by Hollowood, although David Olive contributed, on complex total lattices, where they studied complex total lattices and found real energy eigenvalues. If you look at those Hamiltonians that they were studying, they were not Hermitian, of course, but indeed they were PT symmetric. And if I have time, I think I don't want to take the time to do it, but there are interesting experiments that are being done by Anton Zeilinger, where he looked at PT symmetric crystals. In fact, Michael Berry likes to call them complex diffraction gratings, crystals like this, where you have an eye. This Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but it's PT symmetric, and it has bands and gaps and so on, very similar to bands and gaps in conventional condensed matter theory. And this is a perfectly physical system, and you can construct it in the laboratory using lasers and cold atomic beams. And there are lots of possible and interesting applications for this stuff, because you can talk about, for example, a minus phi to the 4 theory is a wonderful theory for describing what is going on in the Higgs sector. Why? Because this quantum field theory is asymptotically free, unlike a theory with a plus sign here. The expectation value of phi in this theory is non-zero. Coupling constant is dimensionless in 4 dimensions. So this looks like a wonderful way, possibly, of describing the Higgs sector without even bothering to introduce something fancy like spontaneous symmetry breaking, the Higgs mechanism, and so on. You can construct a theory of PT symmetric quantum electrodynamics. You can study PT gravity, and you obtain a repulsive force. I talked a little bit last time, I just mentioned the ADS CFT correspondence using PT symmetric models. I will mention only one other thing, which I think is really cool. In 1954, there was a very famous paper written called the Lee, which was on the Lee model. The Lee model was a soluble model of quantum field theory. It was a very, very beautiful idea by T.T. Lee. But 1 year later, the paper was severely criticized by Shalane and Pauli. And they said, this is no good. This theory is no good because there are ghosts. When you carry the advantage of this theory is that you could renormalize exactly an enclosed form. But in fact, the problem is simply this. In the Lee model, where a V particle turns into an N and a theta particle, this model is renormalizable. This is what the interaction Hamiltonian looks like. If you calculate the unrenormalized coupling constant squared as a function of the renormalized coupling constant squared, what you find is that as the measure, this is the thing that you measure in the laboratory, G, as it increases, G naught squared gets bigger and bigger, that it reaches a critical point where it becomes negative. And as soon as G naught squared becomes negative, G naught becomes pure imaginary, just like this theory here. It's a three-point coupling with an imaginary coupling constant. And you end up with a ghost state. And lots of people tried to resolve this problem. there are, I don't know how many, hundreds and hundreds of papers. And the famous early papers were by Pauli and Wick and Shalane and so on, where they tried to figure out how to handle the fact that there was a ghost state, a negative norm, or an indefinite norm, and tried to somehow interpret the Lee model physically, and they couldn't do it. But in fact, all you need to do is to do a little bit of ghost busting, and it's very easy. What you can show is that at the critical point, when the ghost appears, the Hamiltonian is no longer Hermitian. But in fact, it undergoes a transition from being Hermitian to being PT symmetric. So all you have to do is to calculate the C operator. And for the Lie model, you can calculate the C operator exactly in a closed form. And then you can look at the ghost state and you find the ghost state is not a ghost. It's actually a physical particle if you interpret the metric of the Hilbert space correctly. So I will just quote to you from Barton's book. Barton has a book called The Introduction to Advanced Field Theory. And in his book, he has a chapter on the Lie model because it's such a beautiful model and it's so instructive. But in his chapter, he says, a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian is unacceptable partly because it may lead to complex energy eigenvalues, but chiefly because it implies a non-unitary S matrix, which fails to conserve probability and makes a hash of the physical interpretation. And that's where things stood for 50 years. And we wrote a paper on it 2 years ago. We just showed that if you calculate the C operator, everything is fixed. And there isn't any problem. It just goes away. Okay. So that's a summary of sort of some of the physics here. And let me just point out the connection between a PT-symmetric Hamiltonian and a conventional Hermitian Hamiltonian, because there is one. And the connection is simply this. If you calculate the C operator and you multiply it by P, you find that this is a positive operator. And in fact, if it's positive, you can write it in the form E to the Q. Okay, this is an assertion. I'm not going to explain this to you. And then if you take E to the Q over 2, you can take your original Hamiltonian and perform a similarity transformation. This is not a unitary transformation, but a similarity transformation. And what you get is a new Hamiltonian, which I'm going to call H tilde. This Hamiltonian is Hermitian in the conventional sense. So for every PT-symmetric Hamiltonian, you can map that Hamiltonian using a similarity transformation onto a Hermitian Hamiltonian. And this does not change the energy eigenvalues. I will give you a simple example. This is about the only simple example. This is the only example, really, I know of a non-trivial Hamiltonian where I can tell you both the PT-symmetric form and the Hermitian form. This is it. So let's take a P squared minus x to the 4 Hamiltonian. Perform that similarity transformation, and what you end up with is a p squared plus x to the 4 plus a linear term, x. You notice that parity is still broken. This, I claimed, did not have parity symmetry. Even though it looks parity symmetric, it isn't, because the boundary condition is violated. Here you can see the explicit breaking of parity symmetry, but in fact, the term that breaks parity symmetry is proportional to h bar, and this is an anomaly. Here is the PT symmetric form of the Hamiltonian, here is the Hermitian form of the Hamiltonian. They have exactly the same spectrum. This is not an approximate statement, this is an exact statement. Okay. All right.
And even though, maybe I should say this,
yeah.
Even though the similarity transform is not unitary, doesn't screw up the probabilities for the Hermitian
version? No, it doesn't screw up the probabilities because they're calculated separately in each theory. In one case, when you calculate a probability, you use conventional Dirac dagger. In the other case, when you calculate an inner product, you use the CPT definition of the inner product. But in fact, you have put your finger on exactly the point and the reason for why I'm giving you this talk. Okay, so this is a summary of old stuff, and now I'm going to tell you something new that I am just so excited about that, because that is... So let me rephrase your question.
Okay.
This is the second time this happened, actually. Okay? So here's your question. The question is, okay, so we have unitarity and we have a real positive spectrum, but now you can ask the question, is this different from conventional quantum mechanics? Because there is this similarity transformation. So have I told you anything new? Is there an experimental difference between PT-symmetric Hamiltonians And Hermitian Hamiltonians, can I get a different prediction? If there were, for example, well, so okay, so I will quote Gell-Mann's totalitarian principle. Okay? Gell-Mann's totalitarian principle goes something like, if it is not forbidden, it is compulsory. Okay, so there's nothing forbidding a Hamiltonian that is non-Hermitian but PT symmetric because it satisfies all the conditions of quantum mechanics. So it may well occur in nature. How would you know that you had a PT symmetric Hamiltonian? What is it? Can you give me a clear experimental test? That's the question. And the purpose of this talk, or the rest of this talk, is to show you that in fact there is a clear experimental test that can distinguish between PT symmetric Hamiltonians and Hermitian Hamiltonians, even though there is this similarity transformation connecting the two of them. So that's what I'm going to argue with. And that's why I'm here. Okay? So the problem that I'm going to discuss is a really wonderful problem. It is the quantum Bochristochrome problem. And let me just simply state the problem to you. The problem is you wish to transform unitarily a state in a Hilbert space, which I'm going to call psi sub I, the initial state, into another state, psi sub f. So what you do is you pick two states in a Hilbert space, an initial state and a final state, and you want the initial state to evolve into the final state by means of some Hamiltonian. Okay, so if you give me the initial state and you let it evolve for a certain amount of time t, you should get the final state. Okay? And the question is, what is the smallest time that you can do this? What is the smallest time required? We'll call that smallest time tau, subject to a constraint that the difference between the largest and smallest eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, that difference is held fixed. Okay? That's the quantum. Now, the question is, some of you know the word Bochristochrome and some of you don't. Bochristochrone is a very fancy Greek word, which means shortest time. Chrone means time, and Bochristo means shortest, actually shortest time of flight. Okay. The Bochristochrone problem dates back to around just after 1700. It was posed, and lots of very famous mathematicians worked on it. Lady Child told me that she likes to teach this in her mechanics course. This is when variational calculus was discovered, and the Bochristochrone problem is simply this. You take two points in space, you connect them with some wire, a slippery wire, a frictionless wire, you put a bead on the wire, and the bead slides down from A to B in the shortest possible time, and the question is, what is the shape of the wire that minimizes the time of flight? There's a uniform gravitational field here, G, and you ask, what is the shape of the wire that minimizes the time of flight? In fact, the shape of the wire is a cycloid. You can show that. So the Bochristochrone is the curve that gives you this Bochristochrone is a cycloid. And this was discovered back... there were a whole bunch of people who were trying to discover this curve. Newton worked on it. Leibniz worked on it. Various people, famous people that you know, worked on it. It was solved by Jacob Bernoulli. In fact, I'll tell you a personal story. It was a Friday afternoon, and an undergraduate walked into my office. We have very bright undergraduates in our place. And he said that he would like to write an undergraduate thesis with me. Could I give him a problem? And I said, well, I don't have a problem, but I'll think about it over the weekend and maybe I can come up with something. And that weekend my parents were visiting, and my father was a physics teacher, high school physics teacher, and in fact he, I believe, was Julian Schwinger's physics teacher. My uncle actually was Feynman's physics teacher. And in fact Feynman writes about him all the time in his books. But my father was a wonderful physics teacher. He was terrific. And he was telling my kid, Michael, a bedtime story. And he was telling him the story of the discovery of the Bochristochrome, which is not what grandpas always tell little kids. But But he was telling him, my kid was hanging on his every word, listening to this amazing problem that was solved a long time ago. And I was listening from the other room, and my father finished telling him the story, and he kissed him, and he tucked him into bed, and he put him to sleep. And then we had tea, and we were sitting around at tea chatting, and something was bugging me during this whole thing while I was eavesdropping on my dad. And finally, I said to my dad, you know what? You're wrong. What you told my kid was wrong. And my father said, what do you mean it was wrong? This was done 300 years ago, longer than 300 years ago. It was perfectly, rigorously correct. And I said, nope, it was wrong, because Bernoulli did not take into account relativistic effects. In fact, while this particle is falling, and you want to minimize the time of flight, you could either minimize the proper time or the laboratory time. I mean, there are obviously many different Bachrystochromes. So you could imagine I ran back into school on Monday, and I walked up to this undergraduate. I said, boy, have I got a problem for you. And we actually did solve the Bachrystochrome problem correctly, finally, after 300 years. And we published it. Lots of fun. Okay, anyway, I'm going to talk to you not about the real space Bachrystochrome, that is the shortest time of flight between two points in real x, y, z, t space, but the quantum Bachrystochrome, which is the minimum time of flight from an initial state in a Hilbert space to a final state in a Hilbert space. Now, this is something that has been written about just this year in Physical Review Letters. There have been several papers. Here's one. And let me show you how to solve the problem. It's very simple. It's very easy to solve the problem. In fact, the Physical Review Letter that I just showed you solves it in a very complicated and confusing way. And in fact, it's trivial to solve the problem if you do it right. You need to observe that you only need to work in two-dimensional space, and you can solve the problem using 2x2 matrices. Okay? So all you need to do is to take the initial vector and the final vector and take the space that is spanned by the initial and final vectors in the Hilbert space. And what you do, and of course you're free to choose your basis, so I will choose my basis so that the initial state is 1, 0, and the final state is A, B. And, of course, if the initial state evolves into the final state and preserves unit, and you have a unitary transformation, then it must be that A squared plus B squared is 1, because the norm of this vector is 1. This is for a Hermitian Hamiltonian. Now, all you need to do is to write down the most general 2x2 Hermitian Hamiltonian, which I'm going to write in this form. Okay? And then, where the parameters R, S, U, and theta are real numbers. And remember, I told you there's an eigenvalue constraint. You want the difference between the largest and smallest eigenvalues to be omega. So that condition translates into omega squared is s minus u squared plus 4r squared. I want you to notice that there's a plus sign over here. It's this squared plus that squared. Theta, by the way, does not enter into that eigenvalue constraint. It's just independent of theta. Okay. And now to solve the problem, it takes one page to solve the problem. It's a quarter of a page. It's nothing. All you need to do is to rewrite, to re-express that Hamiltonian using these sigma matrices, okay? And all you need, where you know the sigma matrices, so I'm writing the Hamiltonian as a number times 1, the unit matrix, plus a unit vector n, this n, times the sigma matrices, okay? And the reason for writing the Hamiltonian in that form is that we have to exponentiate it. Okay, so this is just a trivial algebra problem. So if you need to exponentiate something of the form sigma dot n, where n is a unit vector, the exponential of I times a constant phi times sigma dot n, this is just an identity, an algebraic identity, is cosine of phi times 1 plus I sine of phi times sigma dot n. That's it. That's just an identity. And so therefore, if you want to write down the equation that says that the final state is e to the ih times tau times the initial state, this exponential using this identity is just this form. So this formal equation reduces to this trivial. This is just a trivial algebraic equation. This is a two-vector, and this is a two-vector, and that's it. It's just a trivial algebra. And if you, in fact, just look at the second component, the second component says b is equal to e to the blah, 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 times this. Okay. So if you just take the absolute value, you get absolute value of b is this. And that gives you the time required. You just solve this in the trivial algebraic equation. You take the arc sine of this, you solve for t, and you get t, the amount of time required, is equal to 2 h bar over omega times the arc sine of that angle. Okay. Of that quantity. Okay. And then you need to get the minimum time, right? We want the Bochristochrome. Well, the minimum time, to get the minimum time, you have to remember that constraint. The constraint condition said that omega squared is the square of s minus u plus 4r squared. So the maximum value of r is 1/2 omega. And at this maximum, s is equal to u. And so the optimal time, the shortest possible time, here's the formula, is equal to 2h bar over omega times the arc sine of b. That's it. It's a very simple formula, and that's the answer. That's what you'll see if you read physical review, although this is trivial, and what you'll read if you read the PRL paper is will take you much longer, very much longer, very complicated. But this is the answer. And in particular, if you were to set A equal to 0 and B equal to 1, in other words, if you want to map an initial vector 1, 0 into the vector 0, 1, in other words, if you want to turn an electron upside down, take an electron in an up state, put it in a down state, okay, then the minimum time required, tau, is just pi h bar over omega. That's it. That's the minimum time. Now, if you were walking down the street and a guy came up to you and said, tau equals pi h bar over omega, you look at it as a quantum physicist and you'd say, ha, that's an uncertainty principle. That just says that a time times an energy is pi h bar. That looks like an uncertainty principle. It isn't. It's simpler than that. This merely says rate times time equals distance. That's all. This pi is calculated from the overlap of the two quantum states, the dot product of those two quantum states. So this is a distance between the two quantum states. Omega is a rate. It's an energy, but it's in fact a rate at which these vectors in Hilbert space evolve in time. And tau is the time. Rate times time equals distance. That's all it says. Very simple. All right. So just to emphasize, this is not the uncertainty principle. It's definitely not the uncertainty principle. It's just rate times time equals distance. What I've said here on this transparency is what I just said to you in words, and I won't read it again. All right, so now what's our objective? Our objective is to perform the same optimization for a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian having PT symmetry, and I'm going to show you that in the space of PT symmetric Hamiltonians, you can get a different answer from the conventional quantum mechanical answer, and that defines an actual experiment that you can do to know that you have or don't have a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. Okay, so remember what I told you before. A PT symmetric Hamiltonian is self-adjoint with respect to a new inner product that is different from the Dirac inner product, and that the new inner product is expressed in terms of a linear operator C satisfying these three equations. Okay? And for any Hamiltonian, you can calculate C by solving these three simultaneous equations, and then you can define the inner product in terms of CPT conjugation. That's what I said to you about 20 minutes ago. And in PT symmetric quantum theory, the inner product is specified dynamically in terms of the Hamiltonian. The time evolution operator is e to the iht over h bar. And this is unitary, or norm preserving, because h commutes with cpt. So that's the bottom line. And now, the question is, how is this going to work? Well, what I'm going to argue is that for any PT symmetric Hamiltonian having real eigenvalues, there's an equivalent Hermitian Hamiltonian, okay, where, and I'm repeating what I told you before, there's an equivalent Hermitian Hamiltonian, and because there is a similarity transformation, this Hermitian Hamiltonian has the same eigenvalues as this PT symmetric Hamiltonian. Same eigenvalues. But is there a difference? And you pointed out the difference. Okay? And the difference is that states in the PT symmetric theory are mapped by e to the minus q over 2, which is not a unitary transformation. And because it's not unitary, the overlap distance between two states does not remain constant. So in other words, the distance, as you map states in one Hilbert space to states in the other, distances, that is, overlap distances measured in form of an overlap, do not remain invariant. And I'm going to exploit this property of the similarity transformation to overcome the Hermitian limit. So I'm going to do, the title of this talk is Faster Than Hermitian Quantum Mechanics. I'm going to show you that I can get there faster. Okay? So here we do. I'm going to repeat exactly what I did before. So here is a 2x2. You wanted a 2x2? Here it is. Here's a 2x2 PT symmetric Hamiltonian. This is PT symmetric. This is a very trivial example. This is a 2x2 Hamiltonian. T, time reversal, is just complex conjugation. And P, parity reflection, is just given by this matrix. By the way, you can see P squared is 1. The eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian are given by this formula. It's E is equal to this. And the eigenvalues are real, so we're in the unbroken PT symmetric region if S squared is bigger than R squared sine squared theta. And this inequality defines the region of unbroken PT symmetry. Here are the unnormalized eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Here is the explicit form of the C operator. So the C operator is this linear 2x2 matrix. And the CPT norms of these eigenstates are just 2 cosine of alpha, square root. All right. Now, I'm going to calculate T. I told you before how to calculate the time. So I'm going to do exactly the same thing I did before. I'm going to take my Hamiltonian. I'm going to rewrite it as a linear combination of the unit operator and the sigma matrices, the 2x2 sigma matrices, where this is this unit vector. And now the condition, the energy constraint, the difference between the greatest and smallest energy eigenvalue, omega squared, is given by 4s squared minus 4r squared sine squared. I want you to notice there's a very important difference in this equation. This has a minus sign here. There used to be a plus sign, now there's a minus sign. So in these Hamiltonians, this equation is sort of hyperbolic. Whereas in the previous case, it was elliptic, and I'm going to take advantage of this minus sign. And that's the guts of the whole talk, that minus sign. So, of course, there's always a danger to drinking and deriving, but I'm going to do it anyway. Okay. So this is the key equation, and you're going to see that in just a moment. Okay, so the statement that the initial state evolves into the final state in time t is given by this equation right here. It's exactly the same sort of equation. It's just a 2x2 vector identity. This 2 vector is equal to that 2 vector. And I'm going to use exactly the same 2 vectors that I talked about before. We'll try to ask, what is the shortest time for this vector here to evolve into that vector there? Here's the initial vector. Here's the final vector. So if you put in that condition, that the initial vector is 1, 0, and the final vector is 0, 1, I point out, by the way, that these two vectors are not orthogonal with respect to CPT. Orthogonality is not preserved under a similarity transformation. So if you begin with two vectors that are orthogonal, you don't end up with two vectors that are orthogonal. And so all you have to do is solve this simultaneous equation, and you find that if you optimize this result over all allowable values of your parameter, which means that you allow the parameter alpha to approach 1/2 pi, what is the optimal time of flight? It is zero. You can flip this vector into that vector in no time. Okay? The time required to turn one vector into another vector is arbitrarily small. In Hermitian quantum mechanics, you remember, it was pi h bar over omega. And now, the minimum time required is zero.
That's a unique solution? No,
and
no,
that you can't, of course, you can't do it in less than zero, but the point is that you can do it.
Infinity, you could have two solutions, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If it took you, you see, you're trying to minimize, you're trying to do better than the minimum. Of course, you could take a very, very long time to do it, but you don't care about that. The question is, how do you distinguish between the Hamiltonians? And there exists a PT-symmetric Hamiltonian that will take any two vectors that you choose, any two vectors, and allow one vector to evolve into the other in no time. Okay, now there are a lot of comments that I want to make, but I'm almost done. So the comment is that as alpha approaches pi, you get cosine of alpha going to zero, of course. But the energy constraint becomes this. And since omega is fixed, to have alpha approach pi over 2, you have to require that S is very, very big. That's one of the parameters in the Hamiltonian. And also, there's a relationship between S and R, so R has to be very, very big. So the matrix of the Hamiltonian become, the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian become huge if you want the time of flight to be zero. But you remember that we have this hyperbolic relationship. The energy squared is the difference of two things. Each of those two things can be huge, but the difference can remain fixed. You can't do that with a Hermitian Hamiltonian. And that's the trick. That's how we solve the problem. Let me give you the interpretation of this. How can it be that you have rate times time equals distance, and I can argue that the time, if the rate is fixed, omega is held fixed, it's the same constraint, how can you get there faster? Okay? It's absolutely impossible. After all, if I said to you, what is the minimum time required for you to get from here to Andromeda? Okay? You would say, well, the fastest rate that I have available is the speed of light. That's the fastest I can travel. The distance from here to Andromeda is fixed. It's 2.5 million light years. So therefore, the shortest time I could take to get from here to Andromeda is 2.5 million years. That's it. You can't beat that. Okay, but Kip Thorne walks in and he says, no, wait a minute. Space could be very, very curved, and there could well be a wormhole which offers you a shorter path from here to Andromeda. Okay? And we'll call that a wormhole. And now, if you walk through that wormhole, the distance from here to Andromeda might be only 10 meters. Okay? So you can get to Andromeda in just a few seconds. It's not as if you've gone faster than light. It's that you've taken the shorter path. Okay? So when I say that the energy constraint is given, you can't go faster. That sets a constraint on how fast you can walk. So how is it that the distance is small? The distance is small because by choosing your PT-symmetric Hamiltonian appropriately, you are distorting Hilbert space. You are curving, if you want. I don't really mean curving in a strict technical sense. But you are arranging it so that the distance between two given vectors is as small as you like. That is, the overlap between those two vectors is as small as you like. And therefore, in effect, what I'm doing by taking a PT symmetric Hamiltonian is finding a wormhole in Hilbert space. I'm finding a shorter path. Okay, so that is how it works. I'm distorting the Hilbert space so much by choosing my inner product. The inner product, remember, depends on the Hamiltonian itself. So the distance, I'm making the distance arbitrarily short in the same way that Kip Thorne would say, take a wormhole. And that's why it works. And the implications of what I'm telling you are really interesting, because it means that if you can turn, I mean, I have in mind some experiment, you know, where you have a Stern-Gerlach device over here, you have an electron beam, and the electrons coming out are a beam of electrons that are spinning up. And then you have some black box in which you have a PT symmetric Hamiltonian, which as far as I can tell is not forbidden. This is absolutely straight conventional quantum mechanics. And this black box turns the electrons over, upside down, in no time at all, and then you pass the electrons through another Stern-Gerlach device that verifies that the electron beam has been turned upside down. And this whole process, if it takes less time, you don't have to do it in zero time, but all you have to do is do it in time t that is less than the quantum mechanical bound. Strict Hermitian quantum mechanics says that you cannot do it in less time than pi h bar over omega. And I'm saying that with a PT symmetric Hamiltonian, you can do it in an arbitrarily small time. If you can do this in half the time, for example, you don't have to do it in no time, but half the time, then you've beaten the Hermitian limit, and what you have, absolutely, you have, there's no two ways around it, because the only two classes of Hamiltonians that have a real positive spectrum and satisfy unitarity are either Hermitian Hamiltonians or PT symmetric Hamiltonians. And if you haven't got a Hermitian Hamiltonian because you've beaten this bound, then this is an immediate smoking gun. You have discovered whatever is in this black box obeys a PT symmetric Hamiltonian, and that's the experiment. That's it. That's the key experiment. That's the result. And
do you call this Bender inequality?
I don't know. I have no names for this, but it would be fantastic if you could.
BI. Now we're going to have some confusion.
Anyway, the point here, the implications are, of course, very large, because it means if it's true that you could turn electrons, you can flip electrons in no time, it means that if you build a quantum computer, in principle, you can solve very, very hard problems. You can factor arbitrarily, complicatedly long prime numbers in no time. That is, there's no lower bound in the time required to factor a large prime number. It means that the concept of an NP complete problem, you can forget about it. You can toss it out the window, because it doesn't matter how difficult your computer algorithm is. You can solve the problem using a PT symmetric quantum computer in an arbitrarily short amount of time.
So how do you construct such a PT?
I will try to answer your question, but I'll first conclude. Okay. My conclusion is that I'm very excited about PT symmetry. I have to tell you, I haven't been having so much fun doing physics since I first got my degree. What is wonderful about this subject is that essentially any problem you work on gives you a new and interesting result that nobody has ever thought of before, because the field is fresh and new, and whatever it is that you happen to be expert in, are you expert in solving the Bethe-Salpeter equation? Do it for a PT symmetric quantum theory. If you're good at solid anomalies, write down something about anomalies in PT symmetric quantum field theories. It doesn't matter. You'll have a paper in a week. You may have a paper in an afternoon, because that's the amount of time that it took us to write some of ours. This took a very short time. It's just trivial algebra. And I must say, this is just an incredible amount of fun. And I thank you for listening. Yeah, and I'm sorry, you asked, how do you make a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. And the first answer I would give you is, I can't tell you how to do it. I mean, imagine that you jump in a spaceship and go to a distant planet like Krypton, and you pick up a rock in Krypton, okay, and you bring it back to Earth, and you pass electrons through it, and you find that this rock turns over the electrons in less time than in conventional quantum mechanics. That rock is governed, it has a crystal lattice in it that is governed by a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. I can give you some sort of phenomenological experiments about how to do it, how to build a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. And the way I mean, what Zeilinger is doing is, for example, he takes a laser beam, you take two mirrors, you take a standing laser beam like this, and the laser light is created by an atom in the first excited state collapsing to its ground state, giving off a photon of a specific frequency. Right? You take that atom that was used to make the laser light in the ground state. Now you make a cold atomic beam, and you pass the atoms through the laser light. Okay, and as the atoms pass through this standing laser beam, they come out on the other side. Some of those atoms have absorbed light and are now in their first excited state. Okay, so they have extracted energy from this standing laser light. Okay? On the other hand, if you were to put atoms in that were all in their first excited state, then the atoms coming out, some of them would have been induced, would have had stimulated emission, okay? And so some of the atoms will come out in their ground state. Other atoms will still be in their excited state. Okay? So it's clear that you can take a mixture of atoms, some in their first excited state and some in the ground state, and you can take exactly the right mixture so that the atoms coming out the other side are in exactly the same ratio of the first excited state to the ground state. Okay? And this is a phenomenological Hamiltonian that I'm writing down, but the Hamiltonian that you can write down, and this is a paper by Michael Berry and Anton Zeilinger. Okay, the Hamiltonian is p squared plus I sine of x. Okay, so it's a crystal. So this is an atom describing a complex crystal, and as Michael Berry likes to call it, a complex diffraction grating. Okay. Now, if you ask for the physics, if I said to you, what is the physics? You know all about it. If I don't have by the way, do you see why this is PT symmetric? Under parity, x changes sign. Okay. Parity x changes sign, under time reversal I changes sign. So this Hamiltonian is PT symmetric, it remains invariant under PT. But it is not Hermitian. Okay. Now if I take away the I, there's a standard condensed matter course tells you about this, what you have to calculate. Floquet theory, all that sort of stuff. If you want to understand a periodic potential, like sine of x, what you have to do is you have to plot the discriminant, d of e. The discriminant is like a Wronskian, the wave function, as a function of e. And the key point is when the discriminant becomes bigger than 2 or less than minus 2. If you make a plot, the discriminant looks something like this. Okay. What the theorem says is that if the discriminant lies between plus 2 and minus 2, then the wave function is bounded. And that's the quantization condition. The wave function must be bounded. If the discriminant gets larger than 2 or less than minus 2, then the wave function is unbounded and is unacceptable. So you have over here, between this value of the energy and that value of the energy, and here, the wave function is bounded, and so you call this a band. And then the discriminant goes below minus 2,
So the wave function is unbounded, and that's not allowed, so that's a gap. Okay, and then you have another band from here to here. This is a band. Then you have a gap, a band, conduction band, and so on. And this is the quantum mechanics of crystals. And this is band theory, called band theory, and you have bands and gaps, and so on. And the only other thing you need to know is that whenever the discriminant exactly passes 2, at that point, the wave function is 2 pi periodic. So psi of x is psi of x plus 2 pi. And whenever the discriminant is equal to minus 2, the wave function is 4 pi periodic. So it behaves like a fermion. This is like a boson. You know, if you turn around, you get back the same thing. And here you have to turn around twice, covering group, SU2, all that stuff. And here, so the psi of x plus 2 pi is equal to minus psi of x. Okay, so it looks like a fermion. Well, the question is, if you put an I in here, what happens? And in fact, almost nothing happens to this picture, except for one small qualitative change, and that is that the discriminant comes down like this, comes down, but it doesn't cross minus 2 before it comes back up again. And then it comes down, then it comes back up again. But it never crosses minus 2. So half of the gaps are missing. Okay, half of the gaps are missing. So there's no gap here, and there was no gap here, and so on. Half the gaps go away. And what you learn, so what's the experimental signal for PT symmetry? This is a really hard experiment to do. If you ask your experimental colleagues, how do you do this? You have to do some sort of neutron scattering, and you have to see what the wave function looks like right at the band edge. And if both ends of the band, both ends of the conduction band, the wave function is 2 pi periodic, instead of one end being 2 pi periodic and the other end being 4 pi periodic, that's another experimental signal of a PT symmetric crystal. But you ask me, how do I make a PT symmetric crystal? This is a very fancy way of doing it. Okay? This is an example. But if you really want something that you can hold in your hand, like a rock from Krypton, I don't know how to do it. But I don't know that it's forbidden. So I'm proposing this as a possible Hamiltonian that you might encounter in nature. I don't know how to make it in a really non-trivial fashion. Okay. Yeah?
I had a question about coordinate artifacts. If you gave me a
question about, I'm sorry?
Sort of coordinate artifacts, I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you gave me a normal Hamiltonian problem with eigenvalues, I can put down a normal orthogonal basis. To get the same physics out, I would introduce a modified in a product,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that I can now go from 1,0 to 0,1 quicker is just a fact that the physical states that I've chosen are different. And
oh,
it's just
but
that I've relabeled my basis.
Oh, no. This is not the relabeling of a basis. This is if you change your basis by some sort of mapping, okay, you're also changing your Hamiltonian accordingly. And I'm talking about an inner product. You won't affect an inner product. You won't...
If I go to a normal Hamiltonian...
Oh, sure, yeah. But the point is that you have
basis.
To... But if you change the basis, you have to change the Hamiltonian accordingly.
But
it'll
have the same eigenvalues.
Sure. Of course. But
here's... This is maybe the same question. In order to know that you're going from your 1,0 state to your 0,1 state,
mm-hmm.
slower or faster,
mm-hmm.
you have to know that you're starting in the same state and ending in the same state.
Right.
If you have different inner products,
mm-hmm.
how do you know that they're the same state?
Good question.
The way I know how to identify a state is by taking expectation
right.
values of some large set of operators.
Right.
Change the inner product, the expectation value.
Right, indeed. So I can't really give,
I can't give you a clean and honest answer to that question. What I can say is this. That's the reason. That is precisely the... Oh, I erased it. It's the reason why... It's the reason why I drew that picture of a Stern Gerlach experiment and then some black box and then another Stern Gerlach experiment. The best answer I can give you to your question is that over here, when I set up a Stern Gerlach experiment, I understand what I mean by an upstate or a downstate, an electron spinning up or an electron spinning down. And I'm using conventional quantum mechanics to do that. Okay? I don't know why this black box sees that state. I mean, it sees the same state, you know, 1, 0, but it thinks that the state 0, 1 is very close to it, not orthogonal to it, but very, very close. There's almost 100% overlap between those two states. And I can't explain to you why the black box sees it that way. I'm going to simply suppose that this black box sees this state coming toward it and sees this state going away from it. And we then, using a conventional experiment, reinterpret that state as being a spin-down electron. How this black box sees this state, I don't know. In some sense, I mean, if you'd like to object to what I'm saying, let me present to you the objection. Okay? The objection would be that in some sense, this machine sees an electron. But this machine sees this state, same state, and sees this state being very close to it. So it's happy to turn this state upside down in essentially no time at all. Okay? But in some sense, going from in this empty space between here and here, in some sense, one device is using one version of the same Hilbert space, or looking at it differently. I don't know how to phrase that exactly, but you know, it's the same state, it's the same electron, it's just being translated here. But in some sense, this black box looks at an electron differently from the way this black box does. Okay? It could be that for this changeover to occur from here to here also requires time. That could be. And in fact, in some sense, you could argue using the classical laws of statistical mechanics and entropy and information and so on. If I can solve an arbitrarily complicated problem, in some sense, what am I doing to the entropy? Maybe I'm lowering the entropy at no cost. Okay. So you could argue, of course, that's classical statistics, and I cannot do this with a classical machine. I can only do this with a quantum machine. Only. So maybe you can defeat classical statistics, and maybe not, and maybe there's something like a Hawking chronology protection conjecture here that says that there's a certain amount of time elapsed to go from here to here that you can't avoid. It could be, okay, and it could be that you'd argue that if I could do it in less, then you would be violating some condition of classical statistical mechanics, like some entropy principle, and that it can't be done, and if you can make a clean argument of that sort, that would be a proof that the Hamiltonian has to be Hermitian. It can't not be Dirac Hermitian. I mean, maybe that's, you could formulate that in some sort of way. But I'm taking this at face value. I'm merely saying this is a machine that can turn this vector into that vector in no time. I can't give you a clean answer to your question because I don't have one. Okay, I mean, with the question you're asking is a really, really, really hard question, and it has to do with, you know, really what measurement theory means. And I wish I could answer your question, but I'm being straightforward with you. I don't know a really, really good answer, and possibly there isn't an answer. Possibly, the question you're asking is exactly the right question that says, what you've really done is come up with an indirect proof that Hamiltonians have to be Hermitian. But you see that the proof requires, this is quite a proof of it, right? I mean, this is, suppose the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, then you can do this, and this violates something or other. But that's a very fancy proof, okay? It's no longer an axiom of quantum mechanics, right? I mean, but I'm not...
I think you might have a slightly different angle of your answer, but I think that it ties into Steve's and Amy's question, which is, if you take a PP symmetric Hamiltonian, and then you find the similarity map to the Hermitian Hamiltonian, And I suppose by the invariance of pictures, you can go to the Hamiltonian picture, Hermitian Hamiltonian picture.
Yeah.
But you will get the conventional quantum mechanics interpretation of the shortest time itself. Then you take it back to the PT symmetric picture. Then there, perhaps from the examples that you showed, of that one example with, you know, minus x to the 4 potential that gets mapped into plus x to the 4 minus x or something,
yeah.
What seems to be a possibility, which I'm not saying is true, but at least is a possibility, is that, you know, what you might consider an eigenstate in one picture and the eigenstate in the other picture, they receive corrections relative to each other. They receive corrections relative to each other.
They receive.
So maybe the estimate of time using, you know, conventional quantum mechanics is simply based on a misinterpretation of the energy scales for solving the problem. Because if you can map it into the conventional picture, where your PT symmetric Hamiltonian, you know, is in one to one relationship to the Hermitian Hamiltonian, and the eigenvectors are in one-to-one relationship with the Hermitian Hamiltonian quantum mechanics, then the answer which you have has to take the conventional form in the other picture with some non-trivial, non-linear relationship between the energy scales and frequencies or something like that. So...
Yeah, I won't comment on that. I mean, it's... This is a hard question. I mean, this is a... In other words, I can do... Let's put it this way. I can do the algebra problem.
Yes, sure. But until you
you're asking me a very, very hard question about measurement theory and interpretation of quantum mechanics. And if I were to give you an answer, and if I were to give you a strongly worded answer, you'd know that I was pulling the wool over your eyes, and I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to leave the algebra on the board and say, you know, here's a calculation. And it needs to be interpreted, and I totally agree. This requires some sort of serious interpretation. It could be.
In fact, in light of this and thinking in this way, I wonder if you might not already have something which you can test this experimentally. For the following reason, maybe something like 15 years ago or so, there is this paper by Weinberg, where Weinberg was basically asking a question about the bounds on the departure from linear superposition.
Yes, indeed.
If I think about this, we don't really test linear superposition of quantum mechanics in these experiments. What we test is the norm in the Hilbert, the metric in the Hilbert space.
Yeah.
So if you assume linear superposition with PT symmetric Hamiltonians obey automatically, maybe by translating, you know, these questions, you actually get some information.
Can I just make one 5-second comment? Because I know it's late, but I just... Very, very, very brief comment. If you read, you know, these papers, the recent papers that Kip Thorne has been writing about wormholes, he gives a recipe for how to make a wormhole, not a long extended wormhole, but a wormhole that has no spatial extent at all. And the procedure is really simple. You just take a door frame like that, and you put a certain amount of mass on the door frame, and if you put enough mass density, you can curve space enough that you can simply, so long as you don't touch the door frame, you can walk through the door frame, and there are no tidal forces in here that will tear you apart. So if you just don't touch the frame, very carefully pull up your pants, and you just walk through, you're now somewhere, who knows where, okay? And the recipe is very difficult to carry out for two reasons. First, the mass density is something like the mass of Jupiter per linear centimeter, something like that. So it's we're talking about a huge mass density, not something that the engineers are going to make tomorrow. Okay, but it's worse than that because it has to be negative. The mass density has to be negative. And you can't have a classical negative mass. You can only do that in quantum mechanics. The Casimir effect allows you to have conceptually a negative mass. But in fact, that's a very small negative mass proportional to H bar and so on. So we're talking about a very, very serious engineering problem. We don't know how to build it. But at least it's mathematically feasible. Okay. Now, you asked me, Lingli Chao asked me, what what is really inside of this black box in here. And if you look at the elements of the Hamiltonian, they are large and imaginary. And if you were to make a direct physical interpretation for how the electron is interacting with the fields in that box, it is, if you just make a direct transcription, it is as if in this box you have large imaginary magnetic fields in the z direction. That's what's actually a huge magnetic field that is pure imaginary. Now, you can't, this is just like the problem of how to build a wormhole. Okay, what Kip Thorne asks us to do is to accept the possibility of having a huge mass density. Well, that's maybe feasible. But the mass density has to be negative, and that's only achievable by quantum mechanics. What I'm telling you is that you have to have a huge imaginary magnetic field. Now, you certainly can't do that classically. So you need some sort of quantum mechanical system that is equivalent to having a huge imaginary magnetic field. That's what's required. That's what will turn over the electron in no time at all. Okay? Now, I don't know how to make, I mean, given empty space, I don't know how to put in the screws and the wheels and the wires and so on to make a large imaginary magnetic field. So what Kip Thorne would say is, wormholes are not disallowed by the laws of general relativity. They're possible, but rather than building one, maybe we could just fly around in space until we find one. And that's the reason why I said at the end of my talk, maybe we can go travel to another planet and pick up a rock, and the rock already has this large imaginary magnetic field in it. I'm not claiming I can build something like this for you. It's very, very hard, and it's certainly impossible to do classically. It would only be achievable by some sort of quantum mechanical effect where the magnetic field is pure imaginary. Okay, that's certainly the case. So I'm not claiming that there's a classical object that I just connected to the batteries and you've got it. It's nothing like that. But what I am arguing is that I don't see any way to forbid the possibility of such a Hamiltonian. So using Gell-Mann's totalitarian principle, since it's not forbidden, it must exist somewhere in the universe. Okay, now we can have a philosophical discussion about that, but that's sort of where things sit. But what I am saying is, I'm turning it around. I'm saying if you performed an experiment where you did turn an electron upside down from an upstate to a downstate, if you did that, by golly, you used a PT-symmetric Hamiltonian, because you can't do it with a Hermitian Hamiltonian. And that's the bottom line of what I'm saying. So it is a smoking gun. If you can do it, you found a PT-symmetric Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's where the status of where things is right now.